Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 90 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we're glad to feature a selection of RLF writers sharing their enthusiasms with us in My Favourite Author. The greatest part of a writer's time, wrote Samuel Johnson in the 18th century, is spent in reading in order to write. A man will turn over half a library to make one book. As well as being necessary, reading the work of others can be inspiring, provoking, even intimidating for the practicing writer. It's also professionalized. A book is no longer a simple source of readerly enjoyment. It's also the handiwork of a fellow craftsperson. The temptation is always there to go beyond the book's glossy shell, the purr of its engine, to pull out a literary screwdriver or two and take it apart to see how it works. A writer admired by other writers has therefore stood up to some pretty tough scrutiny. So here at Writers Aloud, we like to hear from our featured authors about their own reading enthusiasms. Who inspired them to start writing? Who do they respect and why? Who do they go back to time after time? In this podcast, we've asked four RLF writers perhaps the thorniest question of all. Who is their absolute favourite author? First up is travel writer and filmmaker Hugh Thompson. Hugh's far-flung voyages have included much travel in Latin America, including his earliest adventures as an 18-year-old in Mexico. It's perhaps not surprising, then, that his favourite author is one of Latin America's best-known literary lights.
Well, I think my favourite author would be Gabriel Garcia Marquez, although there's other contenders, but there's something about him that has brought me back to him right through my own writing career. I mean, I read him first when I was 17. I remember reading 100 Years of Solitude in one burst when I was travelling through Denmark and had a lot of time and sitting on this empty beach in Denmark and just getting completely absorbed by the book. And that's where I sort of came into his world and actually came into his world through his books and then travelled out to South America a lot and entered his world even more. But there are a number of things about him that have drawn me back to him, and some it's taken me a while to appreciate. One is that amazing ability he has in his books to tell you what's about to happen before it happens, which might seem to be sort of breaking rule number one of any writer, which is keep it surprising. So Chronicle of a Death Foretold, the most famous example of that, where he tells you what is about to happen in the title, and the first couple of pages tell you that this is the story of a man who is about to be killed later that day. And in a way, what it does is because he gets rid of the narrative expectation right at the start, it leaves you to focus on everything else that's happening, on the way that the story unfolds rather than what the story is, the texture and context. And that's one of the ways in which he's particularly good, because no other writer is as good as evoking not just the look of a place, but the smell of a place. I mean, Marquez's South America is sort of fecund and hot and smell travel. So Cartagena, which he's written so much about in Colombia, you're always sort of smelling the almond trees, you're smelling the hot, warm smell of human faces in the street, you're smelling the bitter cyanide-like smell of the perfumes that Firmenina, the lover of the book, wears, and which her lover is always chasing through the streets of Cartagena. I sometimes think that sort of Penguin should issue his collected works with those little sort of perfume strip cards as bookmarks, so that you can smell each one. But I love the story, coming back to 100 Years of Solitude, I love the story of Marquez when he was living in Mexico at the time, driving down to the coast with his family from Mexico City, a route I've often taken myself, and getting halfway. And this was for a holiday. They got halfway. He had the idea for 100 Years of Solitude. He was so inspired by it that he stopped, turned around and drove back his presumably complaining family to Mexico City so that he could just begin the book straight away and get it down. And it's with 100 Years of Solitude that he starts playing his games with chronology and time, because he not only tells you what's going to happen before it happens, but he also plays tricks with the sort of compression of expansion of time so that you, even the most attentive reader, quickly loses track of quite where you are in the narrative, of whether 10 years have elapsed since the previous page or it's the next day. And so you slip into this strange narrative world where you're not exactly sort of hallucinating in the hospital bed as you read the book, but you're never quite sure where you are. I think he does that in an incredibly astute and clever way, in the way the reader doesn't quite notice, but the reader is always constantly forgetting what he as writer has just told them and then being reminded of it when they come across it in the book. Whether he's influenced me more directly is harder for me to say. I mean, certainly I'm drawn to one of the premises of so-called magic realism, that life is stranger than fiction, or that fiction can be as strange as life, that there are going to be moments, particularly in South America, where you come across the bizarre, but that is also quotidian and normal. And I do like playing of those sort of elements in my own writing about South America. I've read him both in Spanish and English. My excuse for reading him in English as well is that Marquez has gone on record as saying that he prefers his work in English, that he thinks, particularly with Grossman's translations, they read better in English. But I do come back to the Spanish as well, which I think he writes with a beautiful sort of classical elegance. And one of the things he avoids in Spanish is the tendency to rhetoric. You know, Spanish can be a very rhetorical language, an over-rhetorical language. And Marquez, perhaps because he was a journalist before he became a novelist, manages to flatten it a bit and ground it in a way that's very attractive. I think I also admire him because, as a literary athlete, he's as good at the 100 metres as he is at long distances. I mean, 100 Years of Solitude is a famously long book in itself. But yet he's equally good with something like The Chronicle of a Death Foretold, which is a novella, and with the short story format. So he's not a one-trick pony at all in that sense. And I think for someone coming to Marquez, maybe Chronicle of Death Foretold is a better entry-level point than 100 Years, which is quite a mountain to climb. But I like him for that. I like the range. I always regret missing the opportunity to meet him in Mexico when I was making a film there and could have. I haven't heard him speak either. But in a way, he's such a presence in my literature, well, in my life, that I almost feel I don't need to.
That was Hugh Thompson. Magic realism and the mythic are no strangers in the work of our next writer, poet Pascal Petit. Animals also feature vividly in her work, which is perhaps one of the things that draws her to the poetry of her own favourite author.
I have many favourite authors, but the one I'm going to select is the great Australian poet Les Murray. He has all the qualities I would like to have. His poems have sprawl. They are true, they are generous, they are always inventive, and they're even playful when he's writing about really deadly serious subjects, such as cows getting slaughtered, for example. Most of all, I just don't know anyone else who has gone as far as he has into the otherness or being of an animal. His translations from the natural world is an extraordinary achievement for a human being, in that he speaks, or he really does seem to speak, in the voice of an animal. And a huge range. He can speak in bats' ultrasound and elephants' infrasound, in his poem The Octave of Elephants. His poem The Cows on Killing Day even though it's a really grim subject, is one of the poems in English that I most admire of all. It's devastating, but it's a magnificent feat of the imagination. We hear a cow experience slaughter, and the description is just so precise that it's gorgeous. The tractor comes trotting in its grumble, and a shining leaf is with the human. It works in the neck of me. It's just very simple, but these phrases to me just sound so what the air must feel like to, if you could feel it from an animal's viewpoint. I also really admire Les's integrity and his sheer bloody-mindedness and disobedience. He won't be told what to write or think, even if it means being un-PC. And, of course, he has the trances. He writes in that trance state when he says that the heart and the mind and the body are integrated. And although he's written a lecture about this state, it isn't a theory that he adheres to. It's something that obviously he does so easily and naturally.
That was Pascal Petit. Our next writer is Mick Jackson, author of novels, short stories, and screenplays. Some of his writing defies easy categorisation, and that's a diversity he shares with his own favourite author, an author whose work he didn't enjoy so much on a first encounter.
Well, I'm very fond of several authors, but the real touchstone for me is Richard Brautigan. So there's a photograph of him over there above my desk. He's that kind of blonde hippie character leaning against the wall. I read one or two of his books in my early 20s, in my late teens, early 20s, and didn't particularly get on with them. So I'm now amazed that I persisted and read a third book. I wouldn't do that these days. If somebody said, oh, you should try this guy, and I read one of his books and didn't like it, that would be it. But for some reason, I read something like Sombrero Fallout and another one, possibly Trout Fishing in America, which is the one that people have always heard of. And, you know, I wasn't blown away by either. And then I read a collection called The Tokyo Montana Express, which is essentially a sort of notebook of ideas and observations and little stories that are, as the title suggests, split between Montana and Japan. I think at the time he was married to or was going out with a Japanese woman. But essentially they're just his ideas, his observations, his stories that he's drawn, I imagine, from his daily life. So why is Richard Brautigan a goddamn genius? I don't know. And I, you know, it's easier to describe something that doesn't work for you than it is to describe something that you think is wonderful. But I just admire his writing so much. It is so utterly idiosyncratic, and it's full of heart. I think there's a great gentleness and benevolence in his writing. And these sound like qualities that you wouldn't necessarily associate with a writer, perhaps, or with fiction or prose. But there's a real tenderness to his writing, real detail, and I think perhaps because some of his pieces are so short, they're literally half a printed page, some of his stories, so they're like more like prose poems often, as often as not, but there's a sort of collected weight to them when you read a whole collection. Sometimes you're reading them thinking, oh, this is a little too whimsical, or it's got a bit too much levity to it, but then there'll be some element in it that just gives it a real power somewhere. So I don't know, I seem to be interested in eccentrics and Englishness and so on and so forth. We tend to imagine eccentricity as being a particularly British or English trait, but I think he's a great example of a great American eccentric.
That was Mick Jackson. Our final writer is the novelist Jane Fever, who finds echoes of her own life as an escapee from the urban in the work of her favourite author, a once well-known novelist and poet, now unjustifiably neglected.
If I have to choose, which I hate having to do, it would be Sylvia Townsend Warner. I choose her not because I think she's the greatest writer I've ever read, but for sort of more personal reasons, I do think she was a great writer, and indeed an underrated writer. And the reason I love her is that I think she was the first fiction writer that made me feel that I too could write fiction. So I think she's an incredibly generous writer. The first book of hers I read was called Mr. Fortune's Maggot. I think it was published in 1927. It did incredibly well at the time, although not many people have heard of it now, I think. And it was inspired, she says in a little preface at the beginning, by a visit to the Westbourne Grove branch of Paddington Library. She got out a book written by a missionary, a female missionary, I think, who'd gone off to Polynesia in the 19th century. Two things appeal to me with this. I worked once at the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, and I used to be behind the librarian's desk, and I would read some of these things myself. There was a wonderful woman called Beatrice Blackwood who would write these tomes about how she placated the natives by taking a kitten and a ball of wool along with her. And I think those are the sort of things that Sylvia Townsend Warner responded to in this account. So she then went on to write a book that she describes as appearing to her as if in a dream. She didn't go to Polynesia, she didn't read any other books on the subject. She based it on the writings or the letters of this woman and her own imagination and her dream. There were certain things in the detail of this woman's account that really appealed to Sylvia Townsend Warner, just things like a volcano. She describes like the lid on a boiling kettle. So she was the first one to alert me to the idea of how powerful images are in their own right, how active and how creative language can be just in itself, just within a sentence. There didn't necessarily need to be any grand scheme. So then I went on to read a book called Lolly Willows, which again was inspirational because this was this time about a maiden aunt, a bit sick of her life, decides to leave the place in London where she lives and go take herself off to the countryside, bury herself, and in so doing, she makes a contract, as it turns out, with the devil and becomes a witch. This, to me, I didn't realise it at the time, but would be rather prophetic of what I ended up doing myself. When I left London myself in my 30s, took myself off to a cottage in the middle of nowhere and started to write myself. So I found her a very inspiring figure. I mean, the other thing about her, and I think this is the seriously underrated aspect, is that each of her books was very, very different, or is very different. Her masterpiece, I think, is a book called The Corner That Held Them. And I do think that if this had been written by a man, it would be held up as a real exemplar of 20th century sort of experimental fiction. As it is, again, it's a tiny bit obscure. It's got a sort of cult following, but it's not generally available, I don't think. And maybe this is because it sounds rather uninspiring. It's about a life in a 14th century nunnery. But in the span of this book, it covers about 30 years. She herself sort of writes it off in her diffident style as saying, there's no plot, there's no leading characters, you know, why would anyone be interested? Except that she obviously clearly was. She wrote it in the Second World War, a period of terrible, you know, we can't really, unimaginable anxiety, fear. And yet she takes us off to this little nunnery where things are going on, not the sort of wonderfully spiritual, religious things one might imagine, but absolutely the opposite. And her thesis is that actually this is what goes on in religious institutions. I mean, all of which we can see today when we take the lid off, all of this stuff happens. So, and another thing I discovered, this was before I'd even started writing, that somehow these works lodged in my brain as possibilities. When I did start writing and started investigating her a little bit more, there were other things, other more direct sort of messages, in a way, coming when I researched her a little bit more. She wrote an essay which I think is reprinted in her collected poems. She was a quite a significant poet, I think. But this essay was written about women as writers in the 1950s and delivered to, I think, the Royal Society of Arts. In it, she just talks about, the difficulties of being a woman writer because you're outside the party, she puts it. She says there's a building, a palace perhaps, where everything's going on. The champagne corks are being popped. You can hear this amazing party going on, but you haven't been invited and there's no way that you can get in. But instead of bewailing her lot, she suggests, OK, you're not going to get in the front door, you're not going to get an invitation. Why not break in through the pantry window? There's another way. And actually, it's a much more exciting way in. It's a sort of anarchic way in. And in a way, she's not necessarily beating a sort of feminist drum and saying, poor women, you know, we can never get in there. She's saying, actually, it's not to do with their sex that they can't, it's to do with their circumstances, and that women are brought up, certainly in the 50s, to not necessarily be the ones that had the education, all those sort of accoutrements of achievement, that somehow men, she says, she feels sorry for men because actually the education and the over self-consciousness are impediments to actually just being able to get on to mix in low company, the sort of thing that she credits Shakespeare, for instance, with doing. So it's a positive thing to be a sort of humble person, to be approaching things from a sort of pastoral perspective. She describes herself as an anarchist. I think she was asked in her 70s what her political allegiance was now, because actually in the war, I think she actually joined the Communist Party, which I think any right-thinking intellectual would have done. When she says she's an anarchist, I think she also means in a sort of 30s, 40s sort of way. She's talking about being an imaginative anarchist. She delights in the unexpected, in the possibilities, the wonderful sort of unexpected sounds of language, in the power of metaphor. Her letters are riddled with metaphor and just the excitement of language, the explosions of language. When I think in the same, that she was interviewed by Michael Schmidt and asked, OK, well, how does anarchy and formalism, her very sort of stylized writing, how do they sort of work as bedfellows? And she retorts by quoting Walt Whitman and says, I think she's slightly, actually, this is another thing I love. She slightly misquotes Walt Whitman. She says, am I inconsistent? Well, I am inconsistent. Within me, I contain millions. I think Whitman actually says something slightly different. But anyway, that's her version of it. And that's the version I love.
That was Jane Fever. We'll be featuring more RLF writers on their favourite authors in future podcasts. If you'd like to listen to more from the authors featured in this episode, you can hear Hugh Thompson's interview with George Miller in episodes 67 and 71, and Pascal Petit is interviewed by Julia Kopis in episode 38. Jane Fever speaks with Julia Kopis in episode 69, and we'll feature Mick Jackson's interview with James McConaughey in a forthcoming episode. You can also find out more about all these writers and hear other recordings in the Writers Aloud and Vox series on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 90, which was recorded by George Miller, Julia Kopis and James McConaughey, and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 91, we have the first part of non-fiction and fiction writer Lynn Webster Wilde's interview with George Miller. Here, Lynn talks about becoming the enchanter, a very personal exploration of the hidden world of Britain's native traditions, which takes her to ancient places in search of enduring spiritual meaning. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.